You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, amid environmental policy rollbacks, President Trump and his appointees are seeking to limit some of the data published in upcoming climate science reports. We'll get the details. First, it's been more than a year since the U.S. began a trade dispute with China, and during that time, tariffs have been a key tool of choice for the countries as they try to gain the upper hand in negotiating new agreements. Just this month, the U.S. raised tariffs from 10 to 25% on about $200 billion of products from China. In response, China announced that it will raise tariffs on $60 billion of U.S. goods starting in June. The trade tiff has raised a lot of questions about how tariffs work, who pays, who gets the money, and how it all gets enforced. Jim Tankersley covers economic and tax policy for the New York Times. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, when a tariff is imposed, who is the first party to get charged that money? Who is a tariff actually collected from?
Well, so first off, the president would like you to believe that basically we sent a bill to the Chinese government, but that is not at all true. And there's actually sort of a process that happens, which is that a tariff, you ship a good to the United States. It comes in, there's a sort of bill attached to it, and a tariff is charged. There's like usually an importer of record who brings it in and has to pay that tariff. Now, they then usually are working for someone, usually the importer, or the company that's importing the good, who then turns around and reimburses them for the tariff or whatever, or often has actually given them money in advance to be used for the tariff. So it's sort of like a middleman, a third party, who actually bears the brunt of the tariffs to start, but not at the end.
Right. Who ends up carrying some of the costs at the next stage of the game?
Well, so then it gets tricky. Sometimes tariffs are passed all the way on through to a consumer, and you could see very easily how that happens. If I'm bringing in pencils from China and there's a tariff on them, and then I turn around and sell them to kids, and I have to pay an extra 10 cents per pencil, and I can just say, okay, you kids, you all have to pay me a dime because I don't have very high margins on pencils, and I can't afford to eat any of that cost myself. But I might decide that, okay, I actually make a lot of money selling pencils or some more advanced good, and so the person selling this product will pass on, say, 5 cents of the 10% tariff. There's also a chance that, and this is what the president keeps sort of obliquely claiming is happening, that I can turn around to my supplier in China and say, hey, you need to cut the price on this for me because I have to pay tariffs now and I can't afford to pass on the cost or to eat it myself. And you could try to negotiate a different arrangement. So it's some combination of those three things, the actual original supplier of the good, the company that brings it in and sells it, and you know, whether that's a store or a company or whatever, and then the actual consumer. And what the research tells us has happened so far is that a lot of it's been passed on to the consumer.
Another hope that the president and others have stated, and it's often a justification for tariffs historically, is that great news, this pressure has meant that, hey, domestic producers are going to get more business. My American-based pencil company, for example, is going to sell more pencils now. Do we have any indication of whether that tends to happen in fact?
So sometimes, but what you have to have there is basically an American competitor that is cost competitive. And so if I could, and I like that we're just going to stick with pencils,
sure,
which I completely made up for no good and sorry, not at all very Wisconsin reason.
We use pencils here.
Yeah. Oh, gee, okay, good. Because I'm from Oregon, we also use pencils there. It's nice to know we have some commonality across the country there. So if there was an American company that could make pencils for a basically inside less than the difference of the tariff. So I couldn't make them for a dollar, but I could make them for $1.05. Well, then yeah, that would theoretically lead to a lot of increase in American production. In practice, we haven't seen a lot of that yet. For example, I spent some time at a lighting store in Delaware earlier this year, and you know, most of the lighting that you can buy comes from China, and there's only a couple of American suppliers left anymore who make lighting, and it's very high end. So there's not that immediate substitute, and so there's no option to go to it. Now, what we are starting to see is maybe some larger companies moving supply chains not necessarily back to the United States, but around Asia. So instead of putting it in China, you might put it in Vietnam. And that would be one possible consequence here, which hurts China by moving industry out of China, but doesn't necessarily change the balance of trade between the U.S. and the rest of the world.
Talking to Jim Tankersley, he covers economic and tax policy for the New York Times. He's giving us an explainer on tariffs, how they work, and where the money goes. Well, let's talk about where the money goes. Is the U.S. government taking in a significant amount of cash here from these tariffs?
So, yeah, I mean, we actually are. And that is one thing that the president is correct about. Now, that means that's a tax. That's a tax increase. And a decent chunk of that money, which is billions of dollars a month now, that's come in, a decent chunk of that money is then being turned around and given out to farmers as part of the recompensation program that the administration has done to try to help them because they've been hurt by retaliatory measures in the trade war. But yeah, we're raising revenue from this. It's certainly nowhere close to, for example, the revenue that we've lost from the tax cuts that the president signed. But it is new revenue coming in because we've raised taxes on these products.
Now, another angle on tariffs is the idea that they're punitive. We're punching China with these tariffs. It's presumably hurting them in some way. We're getting hit back. And as you mentioned, farmers and others in the United States are bearing the brunt of that. Do we have a sense of how effective tariffs are as a stick to get another country to cooperate with us when it comes to trade?
So on that, I think the jury's out so far. Some threats of tariffs have resulted in at least modest concessions. You know, the Chinese were willing, before the president and the Chinese government kind of both walked away from the deal, they were willing to make some concessions on trade because they didn't want to have these tariffs anymore, in part because they are worried about these supply chain shifts away from China. I think that what we have not really seen, and to be fair, the Chinese economy has struggled over the last year, in part because of these tariffs. And the administration believes that gives it more leverage in the trade war. It's also true that our economy is beginning to struggle a little bit under the tariffs, that there are projections that it's going to reduce economic growth, and that it already has a little bit, although not by that much. And a trade war, what economists usually will tell you, is sort of like an exercise in everybody inflicting pain on each other and everybody hurting at the same time until they sort of decide to call a truce. And I think the administration's view is that it can inflict more pain on China than China can inflict on the United States. Whether that is the case will depend a lot on who ends up bearing the burden for these tariffs. If American consumers are really paying the cost of more expensive goods, you can make an argument that that's actually hurting yourself more than the Chinese. But if supply chain shift and the effects on activity in China are worse than the effects that they can inflict, like on our farmers, then yeah, that might be true, that there is some real leverage here that the administration gets.
The questions come up about long-term impacts. You mentioned, okay, maybe a manufacturer moves a factory from China to Vietnam. Presumably, even after the tariffs are done, they might keep them in Vietnam. That hurts China. There's also concern about China saying, okay, well, we're going to start looking to places like Brazil for soybeans, for example, and maybe they keep that supply chain when this is all over. How do we start to figure out what long-term consequences could be?
I think you've just really distilled very nicely some possibilities. I mean, the first order thing everyone talks about is we're a global economy. It's companies can look all over the place to source what they need. Countries can look to buy various products, and that those lines might be permanently changed by these trade disputes. And the other thing that can happen is that certain products can be substituted out. And so this is a different set of tariffs, but something I just published a piece today on the effects of the president's steel and aluminum tariffs. And one thing that people in the aluminum industry talked to me about is they are worried that if the tariffs stay and aluminum is just more expensive in the United States, which it is right now, than it would be otherwise, that will cause companies, manufacturers, consumers to look for things that are not aluminum to replace aluminum. And so you can have effects on entire industries that have nothing to do with where it's sourced, but just how much consumers want their products. Like maybe car companies don't use as much aluminum in pickup trucks anymore, which has been a real shift that has been happening to meet fuel efficiency standards. So I think that is a big fear in a lot of parts of the economy is, wait, if you're going to make our products more expensive, it doesn't even matter who's going to buy them, just fewer people will.
We'll leave it there for now. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jim Tankersley. He covers economic and tax policy at the New York Times. He was with us to talk about how tariffs work amid an ongoing trade dispute between the U.S. and China. Just about every 4 years, a task force made up of multiple government agencies publishes the National Climate Assessment. The report is seen as a useful tool in understanding the state of the world's climate. But the next edition could look different based on a recent move by the Trump administration to limit some of the data published in it. Now, worst-case scenario data will not automatically be included in the report and others like it, and scientists worry the narrowed scope of data could mislead the public. The National Climate Assessment is one of many reports that could be impacted by rules changes. Steph Tighe is with us now, professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Steph, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, can you talk about this National Climate Assessment and what we do with it?
So the National Climate Assessment has come out, you know, once every, like you said, 4 or 5 years. And it's useful for the public, both in understanding the state of climate science, but also for planners to plan around the current state of climate science. So that'll do things like show types of precipitation changes as a result of changing climate, things like stream flow changes, a lot of different changes. So it's useful both for just sort of scientific purposes, but also for planning purposes as well.
So a state agriculture department might use that, a city planner, especially in a coastal city, say, might be interested in this kind of thing.
Right, exactly. And the worst case scenarios are especially important in sort of planning kind of scenarios, right? You want to know whether or not the likelihood of flooding increases in an area. And especially in a lot of areas, there are regulations that are specifically designed around anticipating floods. For instance, the 100-year, 500-year floodplain is a term that you'll hear in planning documents. And a lot of that necessitates understanding what the likelihood of flooding is in those time frames.
Now, it looks like there's a couple key changes potentially in the works here, including one, James Riley, the appointed director of the U.S. Geological Survey, also recently ordered that computer-generated data reported in these assessments only go up to 2040 instead of the end of the century, which I believe is what they've been doing. What difference does that make as we look at these reports?
Right. Well, like I mentioned, for instance, a lot of states have their planning requirements. Wisconsin has a sort of comprehensive planning requirement for municipalities to sort of set forth basically 20-year plans. Now, right now, right, it's 2019. Some of the times at which municipalities will be on the slate for having this 20-year plan put forth will have to involve data that extends past 2040, right? Just to sort of anticipate this kind of comprehensive planning. So it's going to affect very directly a lot of planning efforts like this. It affects a lot of other larger kind of infrastructure efforts as well. If we're going to change the national infrastructure, having ideas of where to build things to avoid flooding and things like that is important to understand past 2040.
Now, this not publishing the worst case scenarios, one of the arguments that we've heard from the Trump administration is, okay, this worst case assumes that we don't do anything about carbon emissions. So that in itself means it's not really going to happen. It's not something we should be focusing on. It just scares people. It exaggerates the problem. What do you say to that?
Well, there's a lot of sort of dispute in the academic community in general, like the risk community, about sort of worst case scenario. Does it draw people's attention to the most frightening kind of experience? However, with respect to this particular type of worst case scenario, that is with greenhouse gas emissions not lowering, that actually is a very likely worst-case scenario, especially given the types of changes that the Trump administration is making in a lot of other areas in terms of deregulating carbon emissions.
What have the trends been that you've seen in the Trump administration so far when it comes to those regulations of emissions?
Well, one thing that's anticipated that's going to come out, or that has already come out, but there's going to an anticipated challenge is going to happen this summer, is the rollback of the Clean Power Plan, right? So the Clean Power Plan was a move by the Obama administration to limit basically the emissions of greenhouse gases from power plants. And the rollback of it is likely to at least remove some of the regulatory barriers for carbon emissions. Now, there's a lot of other things going on, too, in terms of the economics of sort of fossil fuels versus other types of things. But at least on the regulatory side, right, there's less sort of control over it.
And there's also, we've seen in the news, negotiations and predictions over the Arctic region of the world in particular, and the Trump administration saying that this international report shouldn't include talk about global warming or climate change as we look at the future of the Arctic. What do you make of that?
Right. Again, this is falling under a larger pattern that's actually being kept track of by Columbia Law School. It's called, I think, the Silencing Science Initiative, that tracks a number of ways in which the Trump administration has advocated for sort of less available data upon which regulators, planners, and even scientists can use in terms of approaching climate change.
Is there another good source of this kind of breadth of data that the scientific community can turn to?
Well, the interesting thing is the scientific community can attempt to design around it, right? But that takes research funding, right? A lot of this kind of data, for instance, the USGS data, is helpful for scientists because you have this one uniform source of information that they can use to sort of create their own models and compare different models. Without that kind of thing, you're going to have scientists basically reinventing the wheel. And they might reinvent a number of wheels that makes it difficult to compare their own models in other areas with each other.
Talking to Steph Tighe, professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Steph researches the interactions between environmental and health sciences and administrative law. We're looking at changes in the Trump administration on what kind of data is going to be included in future climate-related reports. A lot of people may hear 2040. That sounds pretty distant. We're doing computer projections. How valid are these kind of predictions if we're going out past two, three decades to the end of the century?
Well, one thing that's important to keep to remind yourself is that climate predictions are not like weather predictions, right? We see weather predictions, and those can be very drastically off. But climate predictions are sort of more overall patterns, and those have become more and more accurate over time. In fact, the whole state of climate science has been the process of developing models, seeing whether the models actually match what happened, and then refining those models. And so to the extent that there's uncertainty, it's becoming less and less.
Now, in conjunction with this move from the Trump administration, there's an effort to create a new climate review panel by the White House. It would be led by the physicist William Happer, who has attacked and passed the science of climate change. Some even within the president's cabinet have pushed back on this. What are your impressions of this news kind of viewed as a plan B, a different look at climate at the White House?
Right. A lot of that has been very controversial in the scientific community because instead of having, you know, the bulk of peer-reviewed science, right, making these decisions, it's going to be the sort of independent panel which doesn't represent the overall scientific community, right? If you look at all of the studies that are out there, the studies aren't just studies. They don't exist alone. They've been reviewed by other scientists. They've been published by journals that have also been reviewed. You know, there's this sort of larger network that is in place that the Trump administration is proposing to replace with this smaller kind of panel.
So for local planners, getting back to that local level, what do they do in the absence of this kind of data that could be removed from the White House? What resources would there be for them to plan, again, for possible impacts of climate change?
They might have to rely upon sort of local scientists who are trying to do these kinds of independent studies. Again, the likelihood that there will be, you know, some particular research that's done in that area will be, you know, it'll be up in the air. They might not also be able to look for it, right? Local planners are not necessarily trained in sort of scientific research. They're not necessarily trained in terms of vetting individual studies. And having some individual, like one single unified source to look to in planning is much more helpful than having them sort of dig up this kind of scientific research themselves.
One possible scenario is this happens now. It goes away for 2 years. There could potentially be a change of administration or not in 2 years. Is it easy to recreate what was lost over that, say, two-year span?
Well, in terms of, for instance, the worst-case scenario thing, if things change in 2 years, that'll be around the time of the next national climate assessment anyway. So that won't necessarily matter. In terms of the sort of modeling past 2040, some of that can be recreated, and some of it is likely to be recreated, like I mentioned, in universities, because universities are going to have to use that data for other types of research. So some of it might be recreated, but it will be more sort of, it'll be more spotty. It won't be as uniform according to the sort of data sets that are already there with the USGS.
What are we seeing when it comes to federal funding of climate-related research? Have we seen a big, not within government agencies now, but at, say, universities?
Well, I mean, the federal government is often the ones that are funding this. So there's been funding drops within the National Science Foundation. There's, I think, also been funding drops within NASA, which has also funded a lot of sort of scientific data. And the other thing, too, is that it's not just sort of funding for science at universities, but university science often relies upon these large data sets generated by the government. And without access to that data set, they either have to regenerate that data or they're going to work in the absence of that. So that is also an impact that goes beyond funding.
Now, dealing with climate change, there's the scientific side of it. There's also a political and economic arguments and about the trade-offs you make as you try to deal with this. Can you talk about the importance of having that science and that research available and accessible as people try to weigh those trade-offs?
Well, one thing that maybe will be, you know, maybe will address your question is that this is something that one of the areas in which that trade-off is expressly being made is the insurance industry, right? The insurance industry is making that economic trade-off because they kind of have to, right, to decide what to insure, to decide what kind of risks are there. And they have to rely upon this kind of data to even design their sort of insurance portfolios. This is coming more and more in terms of sort of supply chain risks and stuff like that. They'll need to rely upon these data. And without things like worst-case scenario analysis, which is something that supply chain managers have to deal with all the time in terms of determining whether or not they can get this sourced ingredient from some country or not, you know, that's going to make it more difficult. Now, that said, I think that the insurance industry is starting to recognize its role in making that trade-off, and we should see some sort of traction there.
We'll leave it there for now. Steph, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio today.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Steph Tai is a professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. We've been talking about a change in the way climate data would be reported under new guidelines from the Trump administration. Earlier this year, Governor Evers released his two-year, $83.5 billion budget. His plan included a wide range of initiatives for the state, including raising the gas tax to help pay for roads, increased public education spending, expanding Medicaid, and more. But the governor's budget plan would require approval by the Republican-led state legislature, which has already rejected a number of key items in the budget plan. Republicans have offered lower numbers than the governor when it comes to higher education funding and the public school budget, and they've said no to the governor's plan to use federal funds to expand Medicaid coverage. Governor Tony Evers is with us now. Governor Evers, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. How are you today?
Well, good. Now, let's start with some of the recent news out of the legislature. Republicans on the Budget Writing Committee, Joint Finance, rejected your proposal to increase spending for the University of Wisconsin system. They approved $58 million of the $130 million you requested. What's your reaction to that?
Well, certainly. I spent the morning at UW-Platteville. And we had a chance to chat actually with people on the ground at the campus, at that campus. And it's reflective of, frankly, the reason I did the budget I propose. And that is because the University of Wisconsin system under Walker took some real hits over the years. And it's time that we recognize as a state that the University of Wisconsin system is the probably the most important thing around economic development in our state. We have to have a strong system if we want to be strong economically and have a good workforce for the future. So, the Joint Finance Committee is the first step in the process, and I'm hopeful to convince others as we move forward and before the final bill is actually voted on and sent to me that that they'll reconsider and put some more money in for the University of Wisconsin system. It's really important. As I said before, it's a driver of industry in the state, and if we want a good system, we have to have a strong resource base for them.
And Republicans have said, though, yes, there were those cuts, but they were balanced in part by having university employees pay for some of their own benefits, other savings like that. So the cuts don't look as drastic as you make them out to be. How do you respond to that?
Well, I heard that same argument with school, our K-12 schools. And because we were able to take money out of the pockets of the people that are actually working at those institutions, whether it's K-12 or the higher education institutions. That's just, let's take more money out of their pockets. That is, in my opinion, a ridiculous argument. We have to make sure that our our employees, and, you know, talking about really important people in the University of Wisconsin system. We're losing good people because of the way they've been treated over the last few years. And taking money out of their pocket is not a way to balance a budget. And so I don't agree with that analysis. I've heard it before, so I'm not surprised that it's still being trotted around. But Act 10 was a long time ago. We're in a different world now. We should be paying people appropriately. We shouldn't be having to, you know, hopefully people stick around. And we're losing top-flight professors. We're losing top-flight employees in the University of Wisconsin system. We can't afford that.
Talking to Governor Tony Evers about his budget priorities and back and forth with the state legislature. Let's stay now with public education funding. It's a big part of your platform as a candidate for governor, part of your portfolio as Department Secretary of Public Instruction in the state. What were your goals in the education funding in this budget?
Yeah, well, our goals were pretty robust. We asked for a large increase, $1.4 billion increase, but you know, again, that doesn't even compensate for the loss that happened, several years ago when Governor Walker was in office. They took money out of the university or out of the K-12 system, and counting inflation, we're not back to where we should be. But the thing that concerns me most is that the amount of money is important, but how it's distributed is equally important. And my budget proposed large increase for students with disabilities and students that are English learners and others that and kids with that come from an impoverished background. My theory around this is not a theory, frankly. It's been proven to be an important piece, is that if a kid needs an extra lift, that extra lift usually costs money. And as a result, our funding system has to be based on equity. And equity was, I think, ignored in what the Republicans have done so far. So my goal as governor is to convince others in the legislature, and I know that people in the state of Wisconsin feel strongly about this, or I wouldn't be sitting in the governor's office right now, and that is we need to properly and fully fund our public schools, whether it's K-12 or the University of Wisconsin system. And it should recognize that some kids cost more than others, and we have a moral and legal obligation to provide those resources. So we're going to be continuing to take the case to the people. Hopefully they'll be helping us going forward with the legislature before they finalize the budget.
You mentioned a $1.4 billion increase you were looking for. The Joint Finance Committee said no, but $500 million they did approve. I want to give a listen to Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald on WKOW-TV in Madison talking about that.
An additional $500 million, that means there would be more money spent on education in this budget than ever in the history of the state. And that's really what I want to focus on, I think, as I talk to constituents and as I talk to my caucus. I said, listen, you know, Governor Evers' budget used a different method for educational spending than we did. We have real numbers before us, and this is a real investment in education, and I think we're comfortable with where we're at.
So $500 million, a real investment. What's your response?
Well, of course it's an investment, but it's not, I think it's less than from what they gave Governor Walker 2 years ago. So I understand the politics of this, but I encourage them to put more money into our special education program, because that's been ignored. It's been flat funded for, I think, over 10 years, if I'm not mistaken. And that's where we need it. Providing more money in the area of special education, that frees up money to other areas. I mean, we have districts that have been pouring money into that program from their local taxes because the state hasn't done their job. I want the state to do their job so that we have a more equitable funding system, and we can start to slow down the number of referenda in the state of Wisconsin. We've been doing a referendum now. Referendum for several years, been passing at great numbers, and I think that should be a telltale sign that the people locally are saying we need more resources. We can't just, and that's not sustainable. The state needs to step up, and I don't think we're the legislature. You know, I'm happy it wasn't zero, but to be honest with you, I think it's not enough.
Before we turn to other items in your budget, one possibility of how this all shakes out is the legislature passes a budget that doesn't match your priorities. You veto it. We don't end up with a budget. Then it just stays as the budget is. We don't shut down. It sticks with the current budget, which might suit Republicans fine. Are you in a tough bargaining position, that being the case?
Well, I don't. I think that's way too early to be thinking about whether we're going to veto anything, whether it's a single word or the entire budget. We're working hard to make sure our case is being heard, and the people encouraging the people of Wisconsin to step in. I believe at the end of the day we will have a budget that reflects the will of the people of Wisconsin. So I'm still hopeful around that.
We're talking to Governor Tony Evers right now about his budget goals, including Medicaid expansion. We'll get to that in just a few moments, and more state spending on education as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for the governor about the state budget? What are your thoughts on school funding, higher education funding in the state, the idea of accepting federal money to expand Medicaid coverage in Wisconsin, investments in drinking water in communities around the state? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Governor Tony Evers. He's with us to talk about the state budget and other issues in it, including education funding and Medicaid expansion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for Governor Evers about our state budget? What would you like to see prioritized? What do you want to see when it comes to education funding, higher and K-12? How about Medicaid expansion and the environment? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's turn to your plans now for Medicaid expansion in your state budget. What were you looking to do?
Well, that's a real important one because it's an important piece for the people of Wisconsin. 70% of the people of the state of Wisconsin have indicated that they want to take the Medicaid expansion opportunities. That will change the face of healthcare in the state of Wisconsin. We by taking that expansion money, and that frankly was available to Wisconsin over the past 8 years, and the former governor didn't want anything to do with it. And so I just came from Children's Hospital today before we had this conversation, and seeing the good work that's being done there, and knowing full well that by taking the Medicaid expansion, they'd receive over $7 million more from the federal government than they do now. That's not chump change. That's an important piece of the puzzle. So by expanding Medicaid, we would cover 82,000 people that are not covered presently, and it would bring in $1.6 billion. It would bring down $1.6 billion to the state of Wisconsin. This is taxpayers' money that the taxpayers of Wisconsin have already paid for, and so it's a opportunity that it's clearly something that the polling shows that 70% of the people of Wisconsin want to have this Marquette poll. And it not only will improve the health care opportunities for those 82,000 people, but by doing that, we'll be bringing in a fair amount more money, as I said, $1.6 billion, that we're going to be able to reinvest in areas that we struggle in. Whether it's issues around behavioral health, whether it's issues about, you know, Wisconsin has a pretty poor record as it relates to the health outcomes of African American babies and moms. We would be able to invest $28 million in programs to improve those health outcomes. We don't need those disparities in this state.
A Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has said that Medicaid expansion is a non-starter. Here he is at a press event earlier this month.
Governor Evers and his allies are not telling the full story. They do not explain to people that if we chose to accept the Medicaid expansion, that would take over 40,000 people out of the private sector health market, where they're paying the rates that actually help to keep a hospital door open. The 30,000 people or the 35,000 people that have chosen not to be part of the exchange, they have the right to sign up for that right now. And as I said, premiums that I think in the Milwaukee market are 18 cents a month with a $50 deductible.
So more harm than good, he says.
He's there's recent research from the University of Wisconsin, which is a reputable research institution, that says that by taking the Medicaid money, it would not only provide additional health care to lots of people in the state of Wisconsin, but it would also mitigate increases in the private sector. So I'm convinced, if you talk about people that are concerned about everybody having access to affordable and accessible health care, this is one way of doing it. If you want better reimbursement for doctors and dentists in particular, and hospitals, this will help do that. It's an ideological thing, and I understand the push-pull on this, but if 70% of the people of Wisconsin say they want something, I think we better listen. And not only is it important to listen to the will of the people, but also to make sure that we actually accomplish something. So actually, tomorrow I'm going to be with Congressman Kind up at UW-Stevens Point. We're going to be having an open mic. It's going to be a town hall talking about Medicaid expansion from 10 to 11:30 at the University Center on the Point campus. Hopefully people will be there and we can discuss it further.
I want to bring on some callers now. Ned is with us in Mosinee. Ned, hi.
Yes, thank you. I think we should accept the Medicaid expansion dollars, and the argument against it is extremely weak. Three quarters of the states in the United States, many of them run by Republican legislators and governors, have accepted Medicaid expansion, including Michigan and Ohio. And so it's just so weak, that the argument by Voss and the others, that we can't accept the dollars because people will lose their insurance. I don't know what study they're citing. We need to start studying the studies that we actually are citing.
Ned, thanks a lot for the call. Governor Evers, Ned saying we can learn from other states on this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's only a handful of states left that haven't taken these resources. A lot of them are Republican states. So it's not something that's going to cramp our style. We're not going to be taking private insurance away from anybody. We're just going to be infusing a fair amount of federal money into the program. And it's not that this federal money is going to go away either. 70 million people are accessing this services across our country, and the bill that created this expansion said it's in perpetuity. So it's not going to go away. It's a 90% reimbursement, which, you know, we get 56% now. So we'll be bringing in more money. We're going to be able to reinvest that in areas that were struggling in the state, whether it's mental health, opioid addiction, making sure that kids have the opportunity to be tested for lead. The issues that we struggle with in the state, we can start to address. And I think this is a no-brainer. Hopefully we can convince the legislature of that. We're encouraging people to call their legislators. There's a toll-free number, 800-362-9472. People need to contact their legislators and encourage them to get involved.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Governor Tony Evers about the state budget. We go back to your calls now. Joan is with us in Eau Claire. Joan, hi.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Governor Evers. My thought is that I found it very telling that after you had mentioned, of course, that 70% of Wisconsinites do favor accepting the federal Medicaid expansion money, that Robin Voss came out and said, over his dead body. Oh, my goodness, that's very strong language for someone who is representing a district. My comment is that apparently these Republicans have no interest in serving the citizens of the state, only their very wealthy donors, which leads me to believe that their very wealthy donors are not interested in everyone having health care. They're only interested in the wealthy having health care. And thank you for allowing me to speak.
Joan, thanks for the call. Governor Evers?
Sure, and thanks, Joan, for the commentary. I think it's important to realize that we have broad support for this, not just the anonymous 70% in Marquette poll, which is a huge number. There's very few things that rise to that level. But also people within the healthcare industry, people that are receiving healthcare services. So it's not like this is something that's been dreamt up by Democrats here or me personally. We have states all across this country, Republican states, that have accepted this money. They feel confident about its success and continue to continue to support it. So I think it's time that we kind of re-engage on this issue. In my conference room, we have a saying on the wall that I think came from Bob Follett. And saying that the will of the people is the law of the land, and I think we have the will of the people behind us on this issue.
Thanks for the call. Time for another caller or two. Mary is with us in New London. Mary, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Governor Evers, in your budget, you allocated some money to support the Family Care Program, a program that supports people with disabilities and elderly and uses Medicaid dollars. As I understand, the money that's been added to the budget will support caregivers, people who care for people with disabilities. But at the same time, there's another program in the state, the other long-term care program called IRIS, hires the same kinds of caregivers, but there's no money allocated for that program, and I'm wondering why.
It's been a long-running issue, Governor Evers. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question, and we believe that, first of all, the Medicaid expansion will show increases to long-term care programs and services, including family care, and for nursing homes and the personal care providers that they have. The IRIS piece, I know we have some increases in the budget on that, and hopefully we'll be able to get that through the legislature also.
Thanks for that call. In just a few minutes, Governor Evers, we have a partisan divide in the country, very strong here in Wisconsin. Do you see a chance to find common ground with your Republican colleagues in the legislature?
Sure. I always believe that. They hear the same thing I do. And that's regardless of the issues, people of Wisconsin need to know that Republicans and Democrats can actually get things done. So the idea that somehow we're fighting tooth and nail on different issues, yeah, we have strong beliefs. But at the end of the day, people want us to agree, come to an agreement. I feel confident that we will.
We'll leave it there for now. Governor Evers, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Tony Evers is the Democratic governor of Wisconsin. He joined us to talk about Medicaid expansion, education spending, and other priorities in Wisconsin state budget as the budget negotiations go on. Still time for you to share your thoughts on where Wisconsin's budget priorities should be. Do you think we should expand public school funding more at the level the governor's proposing or at the lower level that state Republican lawmakers are looking for? What do you think about Medicaid expansion? What do you want to see come out of the state budget this year? You can let us know over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a self-proclaimed church in Madison was raided over concerns about marijuana sales. We'll look at claims of religious liberty and what happens when they collide with the legal system. A public defender's office in northern Wisconsin sent a marketing email to try to get more lawyers from around the state to take local cases. We'll find out why some parts of the state are struggling to find lawyers and a possible solution in the legislature. And in a very special edition of Food Friday, we'll take a look at great resources for home cooks. You could share your favorite cookbooks, websites, or family recipe collections. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time.